Welcome to the Ankler Podcast. This is Sean McNulty of the Wake Up Newsletter here at the Ankler here in New York City on Thursday, March 28th. I'm joined by Elaine Lowe and Richard Rushfield in Los Angeles, as always, where thanks to the power of social media, Elaine has finally found a podcast listener that loves her tennis updates. And I double checked. It's not a shadow account for Elaine Lowe. So just for the record out there, Elaine, do you want to say hello to your partner in crime, your compadre on the tennis court?
Yes. Shout out to our one listener who is also a big tennis fan, Soman, I believe, who is as into tennis and entertainment business news as we all are here. So we appreciate you.
Found a pal for her Venn diagram. So yeah,
exactly. I'm sure everyone else is just going to come out of the woodwork now, Sean.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, listen, it's bound to happen.
I'll let you monitor Twitter for that one. So that's fine. But of course, before we start here, just a reminder, you can catch the Ankler crew over on LA's number one NPR station and Southern California Public Radio's flagship radio station, 89.3 LAist, throughout the day, every Thursday, as part of their Entertainment Thursday programming during Morning Edition, Air Talk, and All Things Considered. And you can reach us here at the podcast anytime at podcasts@theankler.com. Today, we're going to dive into Elaine's look at the state of the revenue prospects for many of the below-the-line industries in LA that make this town work, frankly. And it sounds like a lot of them are not working. You know, Elaine, some fantastic reporting as always, but can I propose maybe we report on, you know, the popularity of the Easter Bunny this Sunday or something, a little more lighter or what, you know, we got to work a little more in the mix here or something.
Look, I would love more optimistic fare here. and listen, it's not all doom and gloom. There are bright spots and we are very careful to look for the upside here.
Yes, it's very true. Plus, Richard did his greatest Carmack impression to tell us what the end game is for the streaming era of Hollywood. Richard, did you put on your Johnny Carson Carmack hat while you were writing, or what was your methodology here?
Yes, I held the envelope up to my up to my forehead. And are we going to do a after show explainer for what Carmack was and Johnny Carson?
I'll let you and Elaine do a sidebar. Elaine, you probably.
I was like, I need an asterisk on this reference.
Nothing on
guys.
That one. All right, I have coming up later. I have an even better one for you, Elaine. So look forward to that excitement.
I'll be doing my bombastic Bushkin impression.
You're really pushing
it.
Love
being on a podcast with a bunch of Gen Xers.
Anyway, we'll dive into what all things look like for the Hollywood deal making suite as we enter 2024 on the studio stage here. And we'll be joined by the newest addition to the Ankler, David Litsky, who dove into all things Michael Kasson this week, the founder and now former leader of MediaLink, a company which has been at the center of claims and litigation at UTA over the past couple of weeks. So David's going to join us in a bit to get into Kasson's history, which let's just say is colorful. And we'll tease it at that. And just to note here also, as I'm sure you've seen this week, Elaine, NBC News making a little bit of news out there this week, Elaine, with the whole Ronna McDaniel fiasco, or as I should say, Ronna Romney McDaniel, which Michael Wolff came and did a guest column this week at the Ankler, diving into a lot of history in her background to know, both in regards to the MAGA crowd and the media industry. Really interesting stuff there from Michael. So it's a great read to check out over at theankler.com. But Elaine, you've had a busy March. Your series business column this week took a pretty extensive look at the businesses that support the business here in town to see what business is like here 4 months post-strike. Maybe we start at the top level here with just, you know, how much shoot work is actually going on in LA right now. What'd you find here?
Yeah, absolutely. And let me start off by saying this is also what I love so far about our partnership with LAist. It was actually a prop master who reached out after hearing me on the radio and said, hey, you know, you should look into these other pockets of the business, which is something I'd been meaning to do, to look at sort of production adjacent, production supportive businesses like studio vehicle rentals. And he pointed me to these prop houses, you know, some of the largest ones in the area, including Independent Studio Services and History for Hire. And so, you know, I was talking to some of these local businesses just to get a sense of how production has been stacking up for them 3 months into the new year. Has it been tracking with what I've been hearing from studio executives who say things are slow on the development front, or writers and showrunners who tell me that there are still things from before the strike that are in process and that are sitting around in development? You know, how has this translated to the production front of things right now? And in talking to a number of them, as well as Film LA, which is the county's nonprofit film office, things are really back up to a fraction of where they are, depending on who you talk to. Mm. Permits for on-location filming are down about 26%. And the more interesting part of that stat is that cast and crew hiring, according to Film LA, is actually down 30%. Now, usually those numbers are in tandem. Hmm. So the fact that cast and crew hiring decline is outpacing permit decline means that essentially productions are coming back with smaller casts and crews. Huh. Now, whether this is going to be a more permanent state of things is TBD, but it's sort of an interesting data point right now here for where we are.
And that's down from numbers that were already down previously.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the last like so-called normal year was 2019, right? And those stats are just for on-location films. When we want to talk about soundstage usage in 2019, LA soundstages were probably humming along somewhere around 92 to 95% capacity at any given point in time. And now, as of January, they were back up from the strike where nothing was happening to around 75 to 80%, but obviously still way down from like any sort of pre-pandemic, pre-strike normal year, and definitely down. Anything you compare to 2022 at the peak of peak TV is obviously going to feel kind of like a kick in the pants. So that's kind of like a weird off-peak year to compare anything to. But yeah, now the soundstage permits are slowly climbing back up, but we won't really know until April what the so-called new normal is. And I mean, honestly, like part of it too, right, is we're all chasing, quote unquote, the new normal. But like, what does that even mean? And right. And this is a thing that everybody's been asking, like, is the slowdown, is this slump really just the aftermath of the strikes, or does it portend something more permanent? And that's what everybody's trying to figure out. Like going to these prop houses, you know, businesses, I think ISS told me that their business was around a 25 to 30% of what normal is. And this is the largest prop house in the country that has 1.5.
This is the go-to place, right? Atlantis is
the
place.
Yeah, they have 1.5 million props, you know, a big marketing and graphics department, 15,000 live firearms in their armory. You know, they service all the major movies, including Superman, which is filming soon in Atlanta, or filming right now. And so it's hard to gauge where things are and where they're going to land. And I think the most striking thing about hearing people who have been in the business for 30 or 40 or even 50 years, as in the case of Studio Pictures vehicles rental owner Ken Fritz, who has the Dukes of Hazzard car, by the way, and the Scooby-Doo van. Wow. You know, they're all telling me like something about this moment feels
the
a little...
General Lee, I'm sorry.
Yes, of course. Yes, very true. Thank you, clear. Richard.
Yeah. And you know, they tell me that things are just, they feel a little bit different and they don't know what it is. And I mean, obviously, we'll see how things shake out. But if you're somebody who's been in this business for decades and you've seen a number of economic downturns, you've been through a couple of strikes yourself, and you can sort of tell from the books and from your own sort of gut feel on the industry that something feels off. Like I'm very curious as to what exactly that is. And I mean, there's a confluence of different factors. You know, there's obviously the fact that, you know, the streaming economy isn't what it once was. We're coming down from peak TV. There's apprehension over the fact that there may less increasingly likely be an IATSE strike now. Sure. So that, you know, creates apprehension in creating new productions. And then there's also the fact that a lot of productions are just moving out of state, moving out of California and moving out of the country.
Right, right. And, you know, and look, there are a lot of gains made in the strikes in terms of pay rates and things like that. And, you know, that money's not coming out of the executive bonus pool, Elaine. So we've talked about it here in the podcast, you know, that doing more with less could also be part of the manifestation here in the numbers that you're seeing, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to the whole offshoring part of the conversation, too, I mean, it's like, listen, it's no secret that there are many more places to shoot than LA now. But it's more a matter of like, how permanent is this going to be? And you know, the matter of tax incentives in California also came up.
Kind of came up as well, right?
So what's I mean, like the Film LA president told me that, you know, while California's tax incentive is quote unquote the best managed in the world, he also thinks it's maybe not competitive enough to keep up with some of the other key regions right now.
Mm, you've written about, certainly Paramount's new approach to that, which is they have a lot of production Elaine. So, you know, if they're not looking at LA, that's a big shift there. So, you know, first of all, you did have a fun day in the prop closet, at least tell me that much. So maybe you didn't get in the General Lee, but.
Oh, yeah. It was fun touring the prom houses.
Yeah, you know, so what's that like? What's a day like at the biggest prop house in Los Angeles?
So I'd actually never visited a prop house until I went to two in a day last week. It's a lot of fun. There's stuff from like the Marvelous Ms. Maisel, or like, right. What is it, that Heath Ledger movie, Patriot? Or
the Patriot, yeah.
And
Last
Samurai. It's a great place when you have visitors to L.A. Taking them to walk through the prop house is a great fun tip for you natives here.
That's good, yeah. I mean, I've lived out here for more than 15 years, and that was my first visit to a prop house. They have like an old Prestwich camera, which was used in Chaplin.
Oh, wow, okay, yeah.
And, you know, then when I went up to ISS, which is all the way up in Sundland, they were making these rubber guns for Superman. And just the attention to detail on some of these replica items is wild, just watching the amount of craft work that goes into it.
Yeah, again, real skilled artisans, Elaine, that, you know, at work here. So that's, again, some paychecks to keep in mind of. So, you know, again, wrap out here, you know, what are folks making preparations for? What is the staffing and forecasting? You know, because again, these big companies have, you know, in-house staff. This isn't freelance. These are people who actually work for these companies. So what are they betting on, I guess, as they look towards the summer here, Elaine, in terms of what they're forecasting and what they're preparing for?
I mean, when I talked to History for Hire co-founder Pam Elliott, who's been in the business for, you know, 30, 40 years, she's thinking that it won't come back until 2025. Mm. And that is in line with this whole survive till 25 bit that I've been hearing go around of people who just sort of still expect things to be down for the year. Although, as we see some of these early results from the IATSE talks coming in, some of like the earlier, you know, agreements, which, you know, the way it works is there's no full agreement until there's all of these smaller agreements that have come into place. So it's going to be hard to say exactly when IATSE and the AMPTP will come to a deal. But so far, it's not looking bad out there.
What makes them think it's coming back to LA ever?
Well, they don't. You know, it's hard to say how much of it's going to come back to L.A. I mean, look at History for Hire. About 60% of their business is in California, about 30% is out of state, and then about a tenth of it is international. And while they do international, she was telling me that they've shipped rickshaws to New Zealand for The Last Samurai. That's right. A fraction of the business, right? And if these studios keep taking more and more business offshore, then they're not going to see that much of it.
But a really great read to check out there from Elaine and Series Business, which you can read over at theankler.com. Up next, Richard walks us through the endgame scenario. I'm just going to leave it right there. We'll be right back in a moment. All right, so Richard, you did your best War Games Whopper impression this week in your column to kind of game out how all the studio merger stuff plays out here in the streaming era. Should I explain that Whopper reference to Elaine now or when to do it later? What do you think?
She can read the footnotes to this podcast.
I was going to say, I think I need like a glossary when I talk to you guys.
Yeah, definitely got a footnote or a conversation. But Richard, what's the impetus here? What's going on?
Well, it feels as though after the streaming war hangover, pullback, that the shoes are finally about to fall. And there's a few things in motion that all made me think that it's coming home. The three big ones is obviously Paramount is for sale. That's been publicly announced. The second one is that the Warner's deadline, when Warner's Discovery deal happened, they agreed not to do any transactions for 2 years. And that 2 years will end at April 11th, 2 weeks from now. So that is coming up, and they are free to try to get another transaction past the government by one means or another. And the third thing was, last week we had the talk about Iger's succession and where it will go. And accompanying that, the government, the Justice Department's suit against Apple sort of takes it off the table as a as an acquisition, as an acquirer for the moment. So all that was swirling around, and it felt like we're about to enter a period of changes where, you know, not the end of Hollywood, but the consequences of the choices that were made during the streaming war will come to bear.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you want to look at it in maybe a year-to-year time, where if we're having this podcast a year from now, there could very, you know, realistically be a pretty different landscape that we're living in, Richard. You know, I think, you know, from last year to this year, you know, it was all about cutbacks, but, you know, materially nothing too much changed in terms of ownership or things like that. But if we're talking March, April, 2025, you could convince me very easily that there could be some very different scenarios out there in terms of the structure of certain businesses in town.
Yeah. So for about 90 years, there were six studios.
Right.
And you had MGM went away, depending when you technically count as going away.
Well, sure, right. MGM. Yeah, yeah.
But other than that, it's six studios stayed on. A few years ago, one of those went away when Fox merged into Sony. Now the fate of two others are immediately hanging in the balance with Warner's and Paramount. And the question of how Disney goes forward and what its plan is also lies in the balance. So, yeah, we could have two of our legacy studios, in the most drastic scenario, two of our legacy studios could be gone in a couple of years.
Or at least in different, you know, way different hands in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, if Warner's ends up folded into Comcast, which is kind of my standing prediction.
Right.
That is essential, you know, that is like Fox into Disney. That is essentially the absorption of
two studios there. Yeah.
Into another one, and will mean a lot less Warners in the world.
Yeah. But, you know, your context around Apple, though, I thought was really interesting. And something, you know, just piecing together a few things that are out there, Richard. But, you know, they've been out in the, you know, the ether there. Apple's not having a great year. And to date, they've kind of been, oh, Apple just prints money and it goes around the world and it's fine. But, you know, you mentioned, of course, the big lawsuit from the feds finally came forward. That is now actively on their plate. The EU announced that they're going to be taking about a year's time to see just how well American big tech companies are abiding by their regulations. And those come with actual penalties, Richard, of up to 10% of company revenues if they, you know, if they find you in fault there in the EU, and Apple's certainly part of that. And there was just a report this week, Richard, in Bloomberg that, you know, iPhone sales in China are down by about a third so far in the first 2 months of 2024. So they, you know, they have a lot of issues there. And entertainment, look, we've talked about it here before, but we don't know, you know, it's not job one, it's probably not even job three at Apple. Richard, so, you know, certainly a Disney deal is probably nowhere near their mind at this point, and who knows what the bigger picture might be there, too.
I mean, given that they've never been able to articulate exactly what the hell they're doing in Hollywood, we could say it's probably not their core concern at the moment. And certainly in terms of acquisition, clouding what's already a difficult regulatory base for them with another giant acquisition that puts them in the targets of everyone, I can't imagine that that's on the table at this moment.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, well, Paramount has had their debt status downgraded to junk by S&P, so they have some more issues over there too, but that says it's a bit of a grab bag. But Richard, I'll end up over here at Comcast, which, you know, things are almost too quiet,
yeah.
You kind of alluded to.
So Comcast, on one hand, you could say they've been kind of the most sober-minded. They didn't go crazy with starting a big streaming service and pour billions and untold billions of dollars.
Some billions, and, but yes, yes.
And went way less crazy than anyone else. They didn't dismantle their theatrical operation. Right. Within film, they didn't decide all we need to do is make superhero movies.
Mm-hmm.
They managed to entirely resist the superhero trend. And all that is paying off for them, that they're the most stable of stocks of the studio. But on the other hand, we know from our experience of Brian Roberts that he's a man who likes a deal and a man who likes business and sort of looks across the table at Disney as his arch rival. And we just know in his heart he would love to be the number one player in entertainment. And they've been very, very quiet as all this stuff has played out lately. And we hear a lot of rumors about, you know, everyone's been rumored to be about to buy Paramount.
Sure.
But when these deals happen, generally they're not the subject of rumors or reports or anything. It's just announced and it comes from nowhere. Yep. And so is the fact that Comcast is not talking about a deal proof that they are making a deal?
Such mind games, Elaine.
Yeah.
Your favorite part of our town.
I was gonna say.
And I'll explain, just to finish up, the Whopper Elaine is the computer in War Games, the classic early 80s film with Matthew Broderick, that it was essentially gaming out end game scenarios for the world in terms of who wins a nuclear war. So that was, you know.
And you have to beat it at tic-tac-toe to stop nuclear war.
Well, now you just ruined the movie for it.
Oh, come on, spoilers.
What are you going to do this weekend now?
Darn, right. Yeah.
Yeah, there was an update, Elaine. Don't watch the original. Watch the Matthew Broderick movie. That one's the way to go for sure. So anyway, you can check out all of Richard's full breakdown there, the final scenarios for the streaming wars over the next couple of years at theangler.com. Up next, David Litsky joins us to dive into all things Michael Kasson, from the current arbitration and litigation mess with UTA to, more importantly, a dive into Michael Kasson's litigation history. Just a great piece from David with Peter Kiefer this week. So we'll get into those details. Plus Richard's expert insight into the big fight this weekend. Does he take Godzilla or go with Kong with the point spread? Richard will tell all in just a moment. All right, the latest new member of the growing Ankler crew is joining us today, David Litsky, who came on board here at the Ankler as executive editor 5 or 6 weeks ago now, I think. David, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. I would like to note that this is my first time podcasting with you and Elaine, but not my first time podcasting with Richard, although I do hope Richard has burned the tapes of our 2012 podcast that predates the Ankler.
Classic from the stacks there.
We're gonna have to pull these from the archives, guys.
Yeah, I think so. Talking about that big NBCU Comcast deal back in 2012. No, we'll see what the topics were. But David, as executive editor here, has already messaged me that I said Carmack instead of Karnak earlier. So David, you know he's on the ball here. Guaranteed proof positive. Thank you so much, David, for the first note there, the podcast. Elaine, you didn't correct me. I mean, come on. What are you doing here the whole time? I got nothing here.
I know. I'm useless.
Yeah. David is also clearly a listener to the podcast, as last week, Elaine and Richard and myself were trying to discern what was happening with the whole UTA MediaLink lawsuit brouhaha and determine not only what MediaLink did as part of the ecosystem there at UTA, but perhaps more importantly, who exactly its founder and now former leader, Michael Kasson, was as the man at the center of the controversy. And David then answered that question pretty well with Peter Kiefer this week in a great new piece at The Ankler. So, David, what do we need to know about Michael Kasson? Or I guess maybe where do we begin? Why don't we start there?
Sure. So Michael Kasson is kind of just one of those guys who is always around, knows everyone, is known as a super connector, has been called a one-person LinkedIn. He has been around for a long time, started as a tax attorney, found his way into sort of the world of advertising, media buying, and then in 2003 started a company called MediaLink that was designed to serve as this sort of conduit between the worlds of media, advertising, entertainment, marketing, and technology, which, yes, is something that I think is part of the fascination with Kasson, which is that no one necessarily exactly understands what he does, just that he does it and that right. He's very high profile, known for sort of lavish, over the top events at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas or at the Cannes advertising event in France in June. And yeah, like I said, he's just one of these sort of sui generis figures that sort of lives in, you know, at the intersection of all these worlds.
Yeah, it's kind of a guy in the ether, I think, maybe something to say. So kind of like Richard, you know, Richard, you're often called the one-man LinkedIn, I think. That's often how you're referred to, right?
Sure, yeah. I'm the one-man Friendster, really.
That's probably true, yeah.
I moonlight as LinkedIn.
So, David, there was this initial burst of news around dueling lawsuits, arbitration, lawsuits that became arbitration. So maybe just break down for us, you know, before we dive into what you and Peter found, but where are we at kind of with things, and walk us up to this moment in time.
Sure. So without getting too deep into the various filings, yes, about 2 weeks ago, Kasson sued UTA saying that it had breached his contract and hadn't fulfilled the promises that it made to him after buying MediaLink in 2021. And then later that same day, UTA countersued Kasson and laid out a very long list of very juicy details that definitely is sort of what got everyone talking about the abuse of his exceedingly generous travel and expense budget, charging private jet travel to the company for personal use, having UTA pay for his driver's apartment, and on and on like that.
And to say this wasn't Kasten's first lawsuit is probably underplaying it just a little bit. So you and Peter dove into a lot of great details to just how Kasten got to where he is now in the industry. And, you know, things one would presume UTA knew when they bought the company for $125 million. But what did you and Peter uncover here about Kasten's past?
Yeah, that is very true that this is all publicly available
public record,
information.
You were not exactly. Yeah.
It is a little surprising that this wasn't a parade of red flags during due diligence. But right. Yeah, so Kasten has been a party to approximately 50 lawsuits going back 30 plus years. He and or his wife, Ronnie, have been the named defendant in more than half of those cases. They're mostly contractual disputes or debt collection, you know, but there's a wide variety of claims. He sort of, yeah, and this was known a bit, that he was involved in a very complicated sort of fraud in the 90s before he was sort of in the media business exactly. And he was a franchisee for a number of emerging chains, including for you Angelenos, El Pollo Loco, if you remember that one. And basically, you know, was accused of, you know, embezzling money from one of the companies doing well and putting it in one of the ones that wasn't doing well. So anyway, but there's, yeah, discovered a whole lot more that, you know, he sort of had a bad experience with an employer where, you know, very similar to the UTA example in the late 90s, where he was fired, sort of claimed that they were trying to destroy his reputation, sort of sued them before they could sue him. You know, we discovered the IRS has just this month, you know, levied a $3.3 million tax lien on his property. There have been a number of instances over the years of Kasten having tax liens from either county, state, and federal tax collectors. You know, one of the juicier nuggets was that Kasten took out a PPP loan at the beginning of the pandemic for $43,100 for his personal corporation. And, you know, again, I think contextually it's important to note that when he first sold MediaLink to a British concern, he received $69 million in cash. That was in 2017, so just 3 years prior. So yeah, there's a lot out there about Kasten, and it is kind of miraculous. He's 73 that he has survived and, you know, thrived, and, you know, until really 2 weeks ago, as long as he has.
Yeah, and you know, when you have, again, whatever, everybody's free to do business with whomever they want, David, but he's, you know, not something that screams, yeah, this guy seems like we want to have somebody buy his company and support his, you know, his spending accounts. But it is what it is. But I think, you know, bigger picture here, David, this is, you know, kind of something, you know, emblematic in our industry right now, where it's certainly something that Ankler talks about a lot, where, you know, the changing of the old guard to the new, and where these huge shifts of marketing dollars are unnerving people quite a bit as well, because they don't understand, you know, thinking a lot of money leaving the ecosystem to other places. But, you know, why is this story maybe having some more resonance right now than just a simple, you know, lawsuit or arbitration matter, do you think?
Yeah, I do think that, right, it does go to a lot of the pressure that all of these industries that MediaLink, you know, sort of ostensibly sort of sits between, tries to, you know, sort of serve as a, you know, conduit, you know, are under. And right. And with automation, like how much a role that kind of, you know, connector like Kasten still plays moving forward, and sort of, right, you know, like doing that as an individual and independently, you know, maybe is one thing, but operating under, you know, a more corporate structure and sort of more, you know, less of the, he's always been kind of out on the frontier. There's a quote actually from Michael Wolff, earlier name check, you know, talking about how he had, you know, been on the Wild West of media buying, you know, back in the day. I feel like looking at his history, he's sort of always looked for that sort of frontier where maybe there weren't as many strictures, you know, in how business was done, and, you know, has thrived in that environment. And UTA is a large global concern that, you know, maybe you can't quite operate that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So any next steps here to note, David, at this point, or what's, you know, the story's not over, certainly.
Yeah, it looks like it's all heading to private arbitration, which, you know, is sort of obviously sad for anyone following the story, because it'll all be private and, you know, won't be aired. Although at the moment, people are still talking in the media. And Kasten has announced just, I think, a couple of days ago that he will be doing an exclusive interview at a marketing event in Miami in April. So we'll have to see what he says there.
Of course, it's at a marketing event. So anyway, yes. A really fascinating and well-reported piece there on all things Michael Kasten, which you can check out over at theangler.com. But Elaine, to finish out here, I got to say I've saved the biggest story of the week, you know, for last year. I finally figured out a way to get Richard into March Madness. You involve Adolph Zukor and Fred Silverman. So I think that was the hook. You know, Richard, how's bracket life going for you in the Anklers player tournament?
No NCAA. It's something you might, they might consider trying. Get some people actually interested in this.
Expand the demos, Elaine.
Game you've got
yes.
going on, yeah.
Who needs
yeah.
all those 18 to 34 year olds? Come on. Overrated. Just a little background here, which certainly all Angler subscribers should know. We're running a players tournament, kind of a March Madness style bracket where we're pitting executives from various eras in Hollywood against each other in the March Madness style tournament, where eventually one exec from each era will face off against each other in a final four for the ages, those eras being old Hollywood, then the Easy Riders and Raging Bulls of the 70s and 80s, the big IP era of the 90s and 2000s, and the streaming era of the 2010s up to present time. You can get in on the action yourself, the voting at theangler.com. Still a few more rounds to go here, so this will be going through kind of pre-timed out to how the March Madness tournament is going in basketball. So, David, you've also been a big part of this here. Any particular upsets you've noticed so far in the early voting? What's the first round or two of voting here? What's been going on?
Yeah, it's been interesting to see that more or less whenever a legendary TV person is up against a legendary film person, that the film person is winning. And so, yeah, I think that has surprised me a bit, just given that TV is, you know, sort of more ubiquitous, you know, generally more consumed. So, yeah, that's my biggest surprise. And in terms of the particulars on that yes, James Cameron up against Lorne Michaels, and James Cameron won, and Tom Cruise up against Oprah Winfrey, and Tom Cruise winning.
Well, there you go. Finally getting the final word there. Richard, anything on your end from the old Hollywood? Any names that were defeated in there here about 100 years later in Hollywood?
Well, when I'm looking at it from the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls round one, we have what looks like a tie between Sue Mangers and Warren Beatty as we go down to the so that is a cliffhanger there.
Yeah, Warren Beatty won in a coin flip that had to be brought in to decide. And yeah, so there are a couple of nail biters as we're recording that we'll see if that coin has to be brought out again.
Sue Mangers was robbed.
Can't catch a break. Oh. It's tough. Elaine, are you doing a little Googling as you're voting here? You know, you up to speed on everybody here? What's been your experience?
Look, I think every week from now on, we're just going to need a separate newsletter that accompanies the podcast that just sort of explains all of the pop culture references pre-1990 for me.
Okay. All right. Pre-1990. Okay. All right.
This is like how I separately need like a Twitter or like an X newsletter that's just like, what is everyone subtweeting about today?
If you just watch every season of The Love Boat and Fantasy Island, probably Hello Larry would help, Hollywood Squares,
of course. Yes,
and
of
Match
course.
Game. You'll be up to speed in no time.
To be here for a Hello Larry reference on the pod, I cannot tell you how happy I am.
Okay, Hello Larry exactly. comes up like a disproportionate amount of time favorite. Around
yeah,
here.
Yeah, for a show okay. that, you know, yeah.
Leaving the greatest sitcom of that era for such a disaster is why it looms so large in the minds of, yes, people of a certain vintage. Of which I am one.
Okay, well, I look forward to your latest newsletter, guys.
It's also a particular tragedy in the annals of show business because it's pointed to as the example of why you never walk away from a hit, where McLean Stevenson, and after the second season of MASH, which was, I think at that point, the biggest show on the air. Maybe All in the Family might have still been ahead of it. But okay. He left as he was commanding officer of the 4077th, and he left to start his own sitcom on NBC, which did not work out, unfortunately, despite its genius. And MASH went on to have, I think, 7 more seasons at the number one slot, which Harry Morgan, his successor, enjoyed very much.
Yes. He's the David Caruso of the 1970s, Elaine. So maybe that's the reference.
Oh, thank you.
For
that helps put things in context. I appreciate that.
And the launching pad of Kim Richards, who you know from Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Oh, yeah. I get that reference.
There we go. We brought it back around, everybody. We got everybody in the loop. This is what we do at the end of the podcast on The Yankler. Anyway, we'll finish up over at the box office where, Richard, we have Godzilla and Kong. Who are you choosing to come out on top? What have your sources been telling you? Give us the scoop.
That's a tight showdown. And Kong, I have a lot of history with, sentimental favorite. But Godzilla has a lot of, if Godzuki reappears and can join in on his side, I think he's got a good thing going.
All right. Well, I'll take Legendary to come out on top because they're the ones paying for it. They are behind the $135 million movie opening through their friends at Warner Brothers, who's the distributor pretty much on that one. Tracking is around $55 million for the weekend with a pretty much larger overseas opening debut forecast. So the second of the franchise, the first one came out kind of during the Project Popcorn era. So kind of a HBO Max and theatrical combo debut. So we'll see what it's like as a solo one. Legendary, of course, also kicked off March with the very profitable Dune Part 2 at Warner Brothers. So they're definitely having a moment there. I'll, of course, break all of that down. Godzilla, Kong, specialty, whatever. We still have more Panda numbers, more Dune numbers going on. We got Ghostbuster numbers, all that stuff. Sunday night in the Wake Up newsletter. And Elaine will, of course, have a brand new series business column on Monday, as always, all of which you get as part of your Ankler subscription that gives you access to all newsletters and podcasts here at the Ankler. Subscribe at theankler.com. And of course, you can reach us here at the podcast at podcasts@theankler.com and follow on the socials at the Ankler on your platform of choice. Elaine and Richard, a pleasure as always. David, did you enjoy your first Ankler podcast?
I did very much. And as I told our producer, I don't necessarily need to be invited back. I just don't want to be banned forever. So that's my hope.
Glowing testimonial. I don't necessarily need to be back, end quote, David Lidsky.
Leave it on Apple Podcasts, would you? A little review? That'd be great. Yeah.
Just don't want to create the sense of entitlement. That's
I mean, you got a tennis reference, you got a Hello Larry reference. I think you got it all. I don't know that, you know, really is need to, you know, but we'll see when we...
That's how we are on Thursdays, David.
This is how we roll. Exactly. Anyway, as always, a big thanks goes out to you, of course, for listening and making this all happen. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you next time.